basically, this is just a biographical oral history, so anything you want to tell me about where you're from and how you got to be where you are and what you've done along the way, both professionally and then any inspirational or anecdotal side notes are always fun.
Okay.
So just start from the beginning.
Okay. Well, I suppose the beginning from the life sciences point of view was when I went to Hambrecht and Quist. And
do you mind if we back up just a little bit? Where are you from?
Oh, okay. I was born in New Zealand.
Okay.
And I went to university in South Africa. And cause
how did you end up in South Africa from New Zealand?
Well, my father was a mining engineer, so we lived all over the world. And I, by the time I was at university, we were in South Africa. So I studied engineering in South Africa. And by the time I finished my engineering degree, I realized I couldn't get a job because a woman of my generation being an engineer wasn't exactly employable. So I did a postgraduate.
Yeah, how did you become interested in engineering?
Well, my father was a mining engineer.
Okay. And, so you were always interested?
Yeah, I'd grown up and I was always interested in science and I was always curious. So it was... What happened, I decided to do the most feminine engineering I could find. So I did chemical engineering.
And why is that the most feminine engineering?
Yeah, there's more women engineers around today.
Okay.
But anyway, so I started doing postgraduate work and I ended up turning what had been a PhD thesis into a master's degree, and that was in high pressure physics. And then I decided to do a medical engineering degree. And in those days in South Africa, it was... Well, first of all, medical engineering was in its infancy, and we had no... I was at Groote Hospital in Cape Town, and we had no... This has nothing to do with the Life Sciences Foundation, but it's actually quite interesting, because Groote Hospital in those days, that was the days of apartheid. Mm-hmm. And I was working in nuclear medicine, and I was working on a project in the transport of iron in the body. So I was using chromium-51 and... iron 59, but we didn't have equipment with this sensitivity to actually track after 180 days. And I had a technical commitment, and so what I was supposed to do was go to classes for a third of the time, do my research for a third of the time, and work with patients for a third of the time in the nuclear medicine department. But because of apartheid, we were supposed to treat non-whites on one day. You know, Africans on one day and white people on one day, which you cannot do if you're running medical studies. So we used to periodically have our department closed down, and the secret police would come in and they'd close us down, and all the patients would get moved out, and then my boss would go down to Parliament, which happened to be in Cape Town, and he'd talk to the Minister of the Interior, and then we were allowed to open again. And that's worthy of an oral history all of its own.
That's
what went on in those days. Oh, yeah. So
what was it like studying at this time, both as a woman and as a white person in South Africa?
It was very, very difficult, and I found it very difficult because I was very young. I was 22 years old, and I had this enormous pressure because we were understaffed, and I was doing all the... basically, you know, all of the blood analysis of patients with nuclear medicine. And we used to have patients would come in from all over Africa. And I'll give you one story, I'll tell you what it's like, was we had a guy came in from one of the administrative districts in what was in Southwest Africa. And he had obstructive jaundice. So we were trying to find out, you know, what that was from. And so they told me to treat him, and you had a whole body counter, and you're supposed to count them every day. And in South Africa, porphyria is pretty rampant amongst the mixed race population, and that's a disease where, with sunlight, your skin breaks out, these absolutely awful pustules. And I had a patient, and I had him on the counter, and I said to this man, "Can you just go in there, and I'll be in there." And he looked at me and said, "I'm not going in there." And I said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "You know, I'll be in a minute." And he said, "There's a bloody colored bin on that machine. And I'm not..." And he actually stormed out, went down to Parliament. Everybody went down to Parliament. He knew the Minister of the Interior. The next minute we were closed down. And I was basically called before this tribunal. Like, why had I you know, told this guy, and I'm like, you know, I'm 22 years old. So I was put on a sort of a probation. As long as I would come in at 6 a.m. for the 3 weeks that guy was being treated and do his counts before any non-whiter got on those nice clean sheets. And after that, I thought, you know, this is just never going to work. Mm. So I just packed up and went off to England. So that was why I never got a PhD.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway.
Pretty good reason to not get a PhD.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you know, then I got a job in England with British Oxygen. And we used in the HEP medical group, and we used to do work with the long-range planning group out at SRI. And I got to go out there, and I thought, it's pretty good out here, and I thought I'd like to be in America, live in America.
So before we move on to your time in America, how did your interests evolve from, because LSF is interested in how people became what they are, as well as, because we're a historical association, so how did your interests evolve from what you called the most feminist of engineering, or feminine of engineering groups, which I still would like to know why it's the most feminine engineering degree, and how did it evolve into medical applications?
Probably if my sister hadn't become a doctor, I might have become a doctor myself, but I was the younger sister, and I thought, well, I don't want to be a copycat. So chemical engineering, why is it the most feminine? Well, we had to study electrical engineering, and I wasn't very good at it. And civil engineering was all out with theodolites, you know, building roads and bridges. And mechanical engineering, as a chemical engineer, you actually had to pull cars apart. And I thought, this really isn't for me. But, you know, with chemical engineering, you got to study. I mean, I studied four levels of chemistry, and I liked that, and that was interesting. And so that's probably why I say that. But there was I had no life plan. You know, I'm always amazed at, you know, a lot of these students who come through American universities, and they have a life plan. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. I had no life plan. So I went to England, and I actually was going to do, I had an introduction to the University of Strathclyde, where they were doing work in early dialysis. If you can believe it, they were doing activated charcoal to do dialysis. You know, it's a far cry from dialysis as it is today. And I went up to Strathclyde, and they offered me a post, and they offered me a stipend, and I looked around, and it was grey, and it was November, and it was sleet, and I thought, you know, I just don't need a PhD that badly. So I went back to London, and there was a chap called Heinz Wolf. He's still alive. He was one of the early pioneers of medical engineering. And he was in, I think, Nottingham in those days. And I went to see him, and I said, you know, I want to be a medical engineer. And he said, what have you done? And I told him, and he said, well, you are a medical engineer. He said, go get a job. And I said, oh, okay. And I hadn't really thought about getting a job, because in this vague way, I thought I was going to be a university professor. So I went back to London and started looking for a job. And I saw that British Oxygen was in the newspapers. They used to use newspapers in those days to advertise jobs. So I went and I looked, and British Oxygen was advertising for a medical engineer. So I thought, well, okay, I'm a medical engineer, I'll go and apply. So what British Oxygen wanted was somebody who would actually evaluate new ideas and show a way that within 5 years British Oxygen could be doing a turnover of £1 million a year with a new idea. So it was actually a very early example of corporate venture capital. This was 1973, so that's 40 years ago. It took several interviews, and I'll tell you the difference between then and today. I was so broke. I had only jeans with flowers on. Remember, this was the early 70s. So I had money, and I went and I bought, because I've been doing part-time work, and I bought one dress. So then they asked me back for a second interview, and I thought, you know, can I afford? And I thought, okay, bought another dress. So then they asked me for a third interview, and by then my money was running so low, I said, well, okay, I'll come for the third interview. And I remember I spent a whole night trying to decide if they would notice if I recycled the first dress, which I did recycle the first dress, and they didn't notice that my guy was job. So when I got there, they said, what's your first idea? And in South Africa at Groote Hospital, working in nuclear medicine, they had started doing medical ultrasound. And there was very primitive in those days. It was what was called an A-scope, where it was just literally, it was a non-persistent image on an oscilloscope. So if you were doing a scan of a fetus, you could barely see the outline if you scanned really fast. So I said, medical ultrasound. They said, what's that? I said, well, I'm not really sure. They said, well, you go find out. It was a wonderful place to start working. You go find out and come back and tell us. So I said, okay. And I went around and met all the early pioneers in medical engineering and who were doing medical ultrasound. And then they said, well, all the best work's being done in America. So I went to my boss and said, well, the best work's being done in America on medical ultrasound. So he said, well, you go and tell us what they're doing. So I said, okay. So I pack up, and in those days, the National Science Foundation was doing a thing called Experiment 5. They should do more of that with the way the FDA is these days. But what they were trying to do was show how you could take a technical idea and get it into commercial practice as quickly as possible. And they chose an ultrasound. And they had all of the key people in ultrasound tied up. So I went to see the National Science Foundation. They gave me the names and addresses of all these people, and I went to see them. And that was when I got to SRI, and when I decided that would be nice to work in California. So
you came to California on that trip?
I came to California on that trip, and I went to SRI, and I went to Stanford. Okay. And it was great weather and everything, and so it seemed to be a good place.
I went to graduate school at Stanford.
Oh, you did? Yes. Okay. Well, then.
Nice place.
Yeah. Well, especially you can imagine, you know, I'm like this sort of, you know, little foreigner running around thinking, wow, this is amazing.
And then it becomes just a goal to figure out how to get there.
How to get there, right. Yeah. So, anyway, so that's probably a huge preamble for what you're looking for. But anyway, so that was, that ultimately led to coming to America.
So you went back to England?
I went back to England. And how I got to, what happened, I'd met these people out at Stanford, and I said, tell me if there's ever any jobs at SRI. And I was in Italy with British Oxygen, and I got a phone call from this chap at Stanford. He said, you know, at SRI they're looking for a health economist. And I thought, well, you know, I'm a medical engineer, so I'll be a health economist. So I went, I was so naive in those days. I went to my boss, I said, you know, I need to go to the ultrasound meeting in Seattle, and by the way, I'd like to go and interview for a job in California. And he said, okay.
So well, that is a great first job.
I don't know, maybe they were trying to get rid of me. So I went, I came out, interviewed for the job, you know, went up to Seattle, and they offered me the job, and I came to America.
And when was that?
Yeah, that was 75.
Okay.
That was 75, right. Okay. And then after I'd been at SRI for a couple of years, I started thinking about what I was doing and what, you know, what SRI was doing, and I thought, well, you know, you have to be in your 20s to have enough guts to do this. I went to all my clients and I said, are you hiring me or are you hiring SRI? And they all said, oh, we're hiring you. I said, okay, if I wasn't at SRI, and they said, well, we'd still use you. So I left SRI and all my clients signed up with me. And these were names like they don't exist anymore, Polaroid, GD Searle.
And what did they hire you to do?
They hired me to evaluate projects technically. And this was in the med. Remember, there was no biotech yet. So this was medical engineering. This was like the technical evaluation and the market evaluation. So because I had these clients on retainers, I was also consulting for some of the early venture capitalists. I was consulting for Jim Swartz, who was in those days working with, I don't know if this name's come up with you yet, Fred Adler. He was mm-hmm. working with Fred Adler. Larry Moore, who was a Bank of America. And there was a guy called Scott Aysen, I forget what his fund was, and I remember thinking to myself, like, well, I'm being paid by the hour, and these people, you know, they have a lot of leverage. So I started doing consulting for equity with some early company called ADAP Labs, and then later on Diasonics. That was an ultrasound company, a startup. And about that time, Bill Hambrecht had started doing investments in healthcare. He'd invested in ADAC, and he had invested in, well, unbeknownst to me, but he'd invested in Cetus, Biogen, and Genentech on their startups. Mm-hmm. And so he decided that perhaps he should get a healthcare analyst. And the ADAC people, he put the word out, and the ADAC people gave him my name, and they rang me up, and they said, do you want to come and talk to us about starting a healthcare group here? And I was about to go off on my first three-week holiday, and I said, well, okay, do you mind if I come when I come back from my holiday? I mean, you know, I so nearly gave away the chance of a lifetime. I went off on this holiday, and on the way back, I was in London, and I was having dinner with a friend of mine who'd actually gone to business school, and I remember saying to him, David, what does an investment banker do? And he said, why do you care? And I said, well, because this firm of investment bankers wants to talk to me. And he looked and he said, well, why would an investment banker want to talk to you? And I thought, oh, well, there must be more in this than meets the eye. So I go back, I go talk to Hambrecht and Quist, and I really wanted to be a venture capitalist. I didn't want to be an analyst, but they wanted an analyst. They actually wanted somebody to start a healthcare group within Hambrecht and Quist. And in those days, H&Q had the biggest venture fund on the West Coast, and it was $7 million, I believe. And it was just really Bill Hambrecht, and he'd hired Denny Van Ness. None of the rest of the team were there at the time. So, yeah. So I thought you wanted to ask something. So I called up Jim Swartz, and I said, Jim, that Hambrecht and Quist is talking to me about a job. And Jim knew I wanted to get into venture capital, and he said to me, why would Hambrecht and Quist talk to you? And I was thinking, wow. First of all, I was amazed at the lack of confidence in me. And secondly, the more they said, sounded, curious, the more I thought, there must be more to this than meets the eye. So I joined them, and shortly after I joined, and I knew nothing about finance, and I told them that, and they gave me a Merrill Lynch book of terms, and Denny Van Ness lent me his Harvard accounting textbook, so I used to kind of study those up in my spare time. But the day I joined...
So why did you take the job?
Because I had the opportunity to do venture capital. Okay. Because it wasn't just research that they told me that I'd be working on the venture deals. They told me I'd be working on corporate finance. I had no idea what corporate finance was. The day I joined, I remember the Dow was, this is really ancient history, but it, it was within one lifetime. The Dow was at 660, and that was August of 1979. Mm-hmm. Before the end of that week, the Dow had gone down to 620. And I think that was the low point. I think that from then on, it just started this massive climb. It had some setbacks. And so, totally inadvertently, I joined at the most amazingly opportune time for, what became this huge bull market that really still continues with some setbacks. Recognize that now in 1979, there's still no thought of any public biotech companies. Mm-hmm. So Bill comes to me and he gives me this set of files. And he said, I've invested in these companies. I have no idea what they do, but you're an engineer. You go tell me what they do. So I said, okay. So it was the files on Cetus and Biogen and Genentech. So I went down to see Bob Swanson and Fred Middleton. And, it was about September of 79, and we sort of sat outside and we had hamburgers and we... And I remember, wow, this is amazing stuff, gene splicing and, But, they were having a lot of fun, and I was just you know, soaking up everything I was learning. So, I mean, nobody had any idea, you know, that the future was about to happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we didn't kind of double down on our investment or do anything like that. And I do know that when we took Genentech public, that I think it was Tom Perkins told Bill that he had to sell Hambrick's stock in both Biogen and Cetus. It was like, you want to be part of this underwriting, you know, this is the horse you're backing. So we also did, I'm trying to remember, I think it was probably after the Genentech IPO, as it was happening, Pat Scannon of Zoma came, was referred to H&Q, and I remember it was Christmas, and I had this Silicon Valley board game that was out that Christmas, and I was playing it in my office because I bought some for presents. And I remember Bill came to the door of my office and he said, I see you're busy, can I have a moment? I'm scooping the board game away. And he had Pat Scannon with him, and they'd been talking about hybridomas. So, you know, Pat and I talked, and then H&Q backed Zoma as well. So we had a bit in each, you know, we had the recombinant DNA, we had the hybridomas. And then we, over time, you know, I learned what an earning per share was, but there weren't any. The first years I was there, there were no public biotech companies. Nobody really knew about it, nobody really cared about it. And so there weren't even that many medical device companies. There were the pacemaker companies, and then there was COBE, there was an early dialysis company, and there were clinical lab companies. I ended up following, in addition, the healthcare service industry just to get enough companies to follow to make it worthwhile. I mean, it's hard to imagine that you had to actually scratch around to find, but, you know, there was Cordis, and there was Medtronic, and there was Intermedics, and there was COBE, and there was, oh golly, I'm trying to think. You know, I was following companies like Amicon, which were filter companies, because there just weren't enough, and I was following Hospital Corp America and NME. And then suddenly we get to take Genentech public, and I get co-opted onto the team as a very junior person. And the drafting sessions were sort of I've been involved in drafting sessions for a lot of IPOs, but these were crazy drafting sessions. They were set up theater style. It wasn't like you were sitting around a table drafting. It was like you were getting presentations on what was going to happen. And I remember David McCullum, you've probably taken history from David McCullum, right?
Yeah.
I remember David McCullum had done estimates for Genentech out to 2020 for its earnings potential. And I remember sitting there thinking, how can he possibly extrapolate earnings for 40 years for this company?
How many people were in the audience for these, or the it was
an audience, right. It really was. I would say that at times it was probably up to 50 people. I mean, you know, it wasn't like you were sitting giving input. You were, you know, getting a lecture, you know, everybody was learning about it. And I mean, somewhere there was drafting going on. And I know that I sat in some smaller sessions.
And where were these sessions?
They were at the company.
At Genentech?
Yeah, yeah. They were largely sort of diligence sessions, but they weren't diligence sessions where you would actually be asking the question and go down and say, you know, let me go through the plant and that. It was like you would sit there and they'd say, okay, now we're going to talk to you about this. And I remember being totally baffled by the whole thing, because now that I'd learned what an earning per share was, I couldn't work out why we could possibly take Genentech public, because it was so unprofitable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, by the standards of a biotech company today, it was incredibly advanced, because it had insulin in phase 3, and it had human growth hormone in phase 2, and it had alpha interferon, was either in phase 1 or 2. And I remember thinking, you can't take a company public that's not profitable. And, you know, David McCullum, of course, was, you know, totally on the other side of it, you know, projecting gajillions in earnings per share. And he was right, as it turns out. But, you know, I was just always been pretty literal about these things. And so we went, I remember when we had this pricing meeting, you know, and we were all sitting around a table like this. And In the doorway was Tom Perkins standing with our head of investment banking. It was a guy called Roy Rogers, and the guy from Blythe's name was Bud Coyle. And I remember H&Q wanted to price Genentech at about 25, and I think they've been pushed up to 30. And Bud Coyle thought they could go as high as 40. And I remember Tom Perkins saying, it doesn't matter where you price it, it'll open higher. And I was sitting, like I was sitting like here, and then Bob Swanson was over there, and I remember looking at him because I knew he owned 10% of Genentech, and Genentech at a $35 a share. I looked and I thought, wow, he's going to be worth $35 million. What a huge amount of money. And you know, when you think about, I mean, clearly Bob's fortunes grew into what Genentech became, but you know, when you think about all these Facebook IPOs and Google IPOs and how much money those young people have made, and Bob at the IPO Genentech made $35 million. Well, technically he made more because it opened at 82. But it was, you know, it was sort of a funny time because I was sort of used to going to road shows where investors would go up and they would ask, you know, questions about, you know, what's your earnings per share, what's your projection, what's this worth? And you were going out in this roadshow and you're having to educate people about everything. And some people were already educated, but by and large it was, you know, very much, you know, not space age, but it was this whole new concept that you had to explain to people, you know, this is a brave new world, and people either bought into it and got wildly excited or they were wildly skeptical. There didn't seem to be like a whole bunch of middle points on it. And when we went out on the roadshow, because I'm a junior banker, I get to carry the bags around. I didn't do the international one, I did the US roadshow. And that I can remember a couple of things. I can remember one time, you know, all the bankers were traveling up in first class, and Bob always traveled coach. I remember he came up and he looked around sarcastically. He said, "I just want to know how the other half lives," and wandered back down to coach.
This is Bob.
Bob Swanson. Okay. Right? Yeah. And I remember one other time when we had. I don't know if I should tell this story, but it was funny because we were in Chicago and Herb Boyer had his girlfriend with him. And she was a beautiful woman. She always used to dress in leather, I remember. Anyway, but Herb wasn't going to go to this meeting until he got a cup of coffee. And you know, you've got to imagine, no Starbucks, there's no Pete's, there's no... You're in Chicago. Maybe you can get coffee in a diner, and it's, you know, that stuff that sits in a pot and it's probably been there for 48 hours. And didn't matter. He wanted his coffee, and Bob's trailing around, and he's trying to, you know, reason with Herb that, you know, we're late. And I'm thinking, I'm the banker, I should tell them, and I'm too nervous to say anything because I'm too, you know, I'm just like totally the junior person on that totem pole. And anyway, he got his coffee, went to the meeting, and everything was fine. But I always wondered what people thought about this girlfriend of his who was, you know, around all the time. And then the other thing that happened was that when we got to New York, for some reason the bankers told the handbrake team that the lunch was at a different place than it was. And I remember we had, because everybody was feverishly taking orders at that point, and I've always wondered how that happened. Anyway, so then comes the IPO, and I remember that morning I was at a breakfast with Cordis, and they were trying to explain why they weren't making their earnings. And somebody just burst into the room. It was like a breakfast. And they said, "Oh, Genentech's open. It's $82. And everybody just emptied out. And I felt so sorry because Norman Weldon, who was running CEO of Cordis at the time, he was just standing there at his presentation. Oh, everybody's gone. So... anyway, so that was a journey. And then after that, then that was when we got more involved with Soma. And Soma started out on Sacrum. Have you talked to PET scanner? about Soma?
I haven't. I don't know if I just started it a couple of weeks ago, so I still haven't caught up on who's been talked to yet.
Oh, Pat. Okay. Scannon. You probably have. I mean, Soma started out on Sacramento Street. There's a house out there by in the shopping area, and every time I go by, and I wonder how the neighbors would have known if they'd known that they had all these, you know, transgenic mice. Anyway, but Soma started, and Soma was doing the magic bullet for melanoma, and that was also, I guess it didn't really work, but it was wildly exciting because of the idea you could target. They were putting ricin on top of antibodies, and so the idea being you could deliver a magic bullet. And what they learned is that cancer cells learn very rapidly, and that whereas you start out and you're targeting the tumor, the cancer learns to pull those particular antigens in or modify them so that the antibody can't glom onto it. And so that whole magic bullet thing fell away, but there was for a few years there was a massive promise that monoclonals were going to be more important than recombinant DNA. In the end, it didn't happen. But I can remember doing an R&D partnership for Soma, and this was actually much later when I'd left Hambrecht and Quist and I was at Erlich Rothschild. And we went around in 84. The market pretty much collapsed, and all of these IPOs had collapsed, and nobody wanted to know about biotech, and everybody said biotech was a fraud, and blah, blah, blah. So we're trying to raise money for Soma, and I remember going around in this big bus, like a big Hertz bus, around Illinois and Ohio with a team of brokers from Erlich Rothschild, where we used to do these coffee and donuts things for dentists to see if they buy partnership units. So, and we sold, we did sell the partnership, but it went from being this whole feverish thing that everybody wanted to own a biotech company till nobody wanted to own a biotech company. And so then I started.
So when was that?
That was 84.
Okay.
It was 84.
Okay.
Yeah. That was after I'd left Hambrecht and Quist.
Okay.
Because at Hambrecht and Quist, I left right after I did the first healthcare conference. And so I left in the middle of 83.
Right. We'll want to go back and talk about that conference.
Okay.
So you took Genentech public.
Right.
And then how did you get from there to organizing this amazing conference?
Well, what happened was that in those days, the best research in the whole healthcare area was done by Alex Brown. And they had an analyst, John Nehra, and he had a conference in May that was very, very popular. And I suggested to Cliff Higgison, who was head of research at the time, I said, you know, we should probably do a healthcare conference. Mm-hmm. And he said, what do you have in mind? And I said, well, I think that, you know, certainly we want to do it before the Alex Brown conference. And in January, where people have got new budgets and new ideas and the weather's bad on the East Coast, we should probably do it right after New Year. And actually, I believe even to this day that the key to the success of that conference was the timing. The timing was... turned out that everything I thought was true was true. The people from the East Coast wanted to come to the West Coast. They'd all like, okay, last year's behind us, what's new, what's happening? And they all came. So we did, I got permission to put the conference together. And it was really the same thing of how do you get enough people to come to a conference like that as invited speakers, because there weren't that many companies that people were that interested in. So we ended up, I think we were 22 companies, and it was the biotech, and it was medtech, and it was healthcare services. And so all the people that we invited came.
Yep,
that's it.
Yeah.
And we had, and there were 220 people as attendees, which was also pretty good for first conference, and it was And then we bussed everybody the third day down to see Diasonics and to see Genentech. And we didn't go to Cetus. And the reason we didn't go to Cetus was I think the Cetus people were really mad with us because Bill had sold the Cetus stock so we could take Genentech public. And so we were on the other side of that. And I think Elif Rothschild, and I'm not sure whom else, took Cetus public. But I had been told that I probably shouldn't, you know, follow Cetus because of, you know, all of these things that had gone on that I had nothing to do with. So it was, and I put that conference together just myself and my assistant. And when I actually think about now how complex all these things are, I mean, you know, we had none of the modern tools, and we just put it together and we just did it. And it was pretty successful, that first one. I guess it must have been because it's still going.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty amazing program. I was looking through it last night. I would have loved to have attended.
Yeah, well, we did a lot of, we had a lot of speakers at lunches, and we had, I remember Bill Hambrick coming and looking in on one session, and his eyes widened. And the one thing that ruined it for me personally was that I remember the day before the conference began, I was invited to a lunch that Leon Hirsch, who was the CEO of US Surgical, and US Surgical was sold to what became Covidien, was a massively fast-growing surgical stapling company. And he invited me and a couple of other Hambrick people to lunch. And I remember sitting there feeling this little pain in my jaw. And cut a long story short, it was the first and the only tooth abscess I've ever had. And by the next day, but the point is, it was only me. There wasn't like, there was somebody I could say, here, do you mind handing this off? I've got to go see a doctor. And by the end of the conference, I could hardly open my mouth. I was just so, my jaw was swollen, and I was just popping Tylenol like they were candies. And the minute that the thing was over, I went right down to the emergency room and put me on antibiotics. But that was a miserable sideline of that whole thing. But but I couldn't believe that actually that people came and everybody enjoyed themselves, and it was a good conference, even though it was So
that was sometime while you were there, that was after you became a partner, right?
Yeah, I became a partner at the end of 81, I think. Okay.
And that just sort of happened as part of the.
That actually, even today, I still think that was the biggest achievement of my career.
Yeah, why is that?
Becoming a partner at Hambrick & Quist. Well, there's a lot of people will claim to have been the first or the only woman partner at Hambrick & Quist, but actually, I did become a partner at Hambrick & Quist when it was still a partnership. And I knew that things were split a little bit about bringing in a woman as a partner. And they always had a partner's lunch. And it was always this apparently big boozy affair with, you know, cigars and stories and feet up on the table. And they had it at the Pacific Union Club. And now because they had a woman partner, they couldn't have me there. And so they couldn't have the lunch there. So then they couldn't have the lunch at the Bohemian Club either. And they ended up at the Olympic Club in a crummy room, and I know George Quist was very unhappy about it. And there's two things I remember about this lunch. Was one of the partners sat next to me, and he said, Annette, do me a favor, next year at the partners lunch, will you go on a business trip so we can have fun again? And another of the partners stood up and said, here's a toast to Annette, our first woman partner. Next year we'll have a lunch at her house and she can cook. Can you imagine in today's world either of those things taking place?
Only as a really terrible joke.
Yeah. I mean, it just wouldn't happen.
Wow. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I remember, and I always get a lot of flack for this, but the Pacific Union Club relented and said that I could go to the cocktail party that George Quist always had at the PU Club. Well, actually, George Quist, I found later, threatened to resign if they didn't let me in. But I had to go in the back door.
Wow.
Through the kitchen.
Wow.
And I remember the women at Hambrington Quist were saying to me, you can't go. There was a woman, I remember her name was Marge Goddard. She was one of the associates. She said, you can't go. And I said, no. I said, I grew up in South Africa, and now this is my chance to see what apartheid's like. Hmm. And... And, you know, and so there was, it was just such a different time. And
so how did you become a partner if there was so much resentment or conflict about it?
Chauvinism, you mean?
Yeah,
I mean,
yes.
That's really what it was. You know, I just worked really hard. Mm-hmm. And I had built up this big group of companies that we were following, and... You know, I was obviously bringing in commissions for the firm with the healthcare companies, and you know, I used to get to work at before 7 in the morning, and I'd stay till 7 at night, and I wouldn't leave my desk, and you know, that's what happened, you know. And so, you know, if you really just set out to do something, it doesn't really matter if you're a woman, you've just got to kind of ignore the gallery and just go for it. And I really wanted to be a partner in Hambrington Quist, and so that was what happened. Yeah.
Congratulations. So somewhere along there, there's a note here that you met your husband while you were there.
Yeah, that was not while I was at Hambrington Quist, but I left Hambrington Quist and went to L.F. Rothschild. That was a big mistake. Mm-hmm. And the reason it was a big mistake was that I thought that at H&Q sooner or later I could become a partner just in the venture capital group and I wouldn't have to do research, and it was clear that wasn't going to happen. And L.F. Rothschild was raising a venture fund, and they told me that when they raised the fund that I could take part of it and run it as a healthcare fund. And so I jumped ship and went to L.F. Rothschild, and that was, for so many reasons, that was a big mistake. And actually, L.F. Rothschild, after I quit and went off to do what became MedVenture, L.F. Rothschild actually went out of business in 86. But anyway, Rothschild had, along with Hambrecht and what was then F. Eberstadt, had taken Diasonics public, and I had money in the founding of Diasonics because that was one of the companies I worked for equity, and I also invested in it. And Diasonics was the biggest IPO of 1983. It was on the cover of Fortune magazine. It was like all the little toasters coming down, but they were not toasters. They were little ultrasound machines, and there were people quoted as saying, I wouldn't know a Diasonics if it fell on me, but I have to own the stock. And, you know, 1983, it was a billion-dollar IPO, raised $100 million, and within a year all the money was gone. Mm-hmm. And there was fraud alleged, and they brought in a turnaround. Hambrecht & Quist brought in a turnaround team, and my husband was one of the people in the turnaround team who went into Diasonics as a CFO. So I met him that way, because L.F. Rothschild was involved, and I was told to go down and see if we were going to put money in the turnaround. And actually, Rudy and I, for the first 6 months, he called me Miss Campbell White, and I called him Dr. Nauman. We were very proper about it. Yeah, but yes, I did meet him that way, but not when I was at Hambrecht, when I had this little sojourn at L.F. Rothschild. And then when it became clear that L.F. Rothschild was never going to raise a venture fund, that was when I decided that I should raise a fund on my own. And
that was in 86?
Well, I closed it in 86. It was in 85. And, and the logic was that I felt like I'd been a partner in Hambrecht & Quist. And when I went over to L.F. Rothschild, I was a partner. And that didn't mean as much as at Hambrecht & Quist. But then I thought, well, any venture fund, they were just offering me like little associate roles, and I thought, that's not right because of what I've done, and that should be valued more. So I thought, well, hell with it, I'll do it myself. And I went to Bill Bowes, and I said, Bill, and I knew Bill from Zoma. I don't know how I knew Bill. I just knew Bill. And I went and I had lunch with him, and I said, Bill, do you know any venture firm that might back a small life science-focused venture fund? And he said, sure, we would do that. And I said, well, you would? And he said, sure. He said, we're, you know, as strategically, we're thinking we'll take. So they, he gave me the first $1 million from US Ventures, and they became a special limited partner, my first fund. And InterWest, who, you know, I knew the partners at InterWest pretty well, and they did the same thing later on. But once I had US Ventures backing me, then the whole idea started becoming more real. Mm-hmm. So I raised this mighty sum of $12 million, which, you know, but you've got to put it in perspective. In those days, a big fund was $100 million. Mm-hmm. So you raise $12 million for a single-person fund is still, it's still pretty useful.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the financing? Were there innovations that were going on at the time, and how is it different from how venture capital firms invest in biotech now?
It was way more collegial. Mm-hmm. Was way more collegial. I mean, for example, when I was at Hambrington Quest, it was super collegial. I mean, I remember when we invested in Home Healthcare of America, I got a call from Frank Caulfield. He said, I've got a guy in my office and we've invested in him, and we've got a moment, I'll bring him over. So that was Jim Sweeney, brought him over, and then we sat around, we talked about Home Healthcare of America, and I called Grant Emma and we said, this is a great idea, we should do this deal. That would never happen today. Never happen. And it was much more, I mean, in the early days, we had a little group that we put together where we would have dinner once, at least once a quarter, and sometimes, you know, usually at least every 6 weeks, and somebody would, and it was like Gordon Russell, who was at Sequoia, and Bill, and Bob Momsen from InterWest, and me, and we'd, you know, try and get a speaker from a, you know, life sciences company, and we'd share ideas, we'd share deals. Nobody does that now, you know. And it was sort of understood that if you'd had a company that you were creating and you were raising money, that you got rewarded for raising, for building the value that would lead to the next round. So there was an expectation that, okay, if you've done the Series D at $1 a share, depending on where you've taken the company and where you think, you know, it wasn't like, will you get a step up? It's what sort of step up will you get? Which made it worthwhile to do early stage investing, because you would own less of a bigger pie. Mm-hmm. These days, you never, there's just, with a rare exception, the whole idea is different. It's turned around. It's like, okay, fine, you know, you've built all this value, now you're vulnerable, you need money, you know, what sort of preferences can I stick on it so that it makes what you've done less valuable? And it's tremendous disincentive now compared to what it was. So yeah, it was very, very different. And I mean, I'll tell you about the founding of Glycomed, which was that was sort of a classic example, was that I had met John Clark, who had the idea of doing, because he kept saying it's not only proteins, the carbohydrates are equally important. And so we spent time talking about his ideas of, you know, useful carbohydrates for medicine. And so I introduced him to Bill Bose, and somehow or other, I think Bill must have talked to Gordon Russell, but anyway, there was a woman there, Nancy Olson, working at Sequoia in those days, and Nancy knew Brian Atwood, who was had been a CETUS, and because the feeling was that John's ideas were great, but there was no business structure to them, so we introduced John and Brian, and they came off and came back with a business plan for Glycomed. So, you know, Bill talked to Kleiner Perkins and Brooke Byers, and next minute there's this deal, you know, we're going to raise this amount of money, Bill's going to be the chairman. And I remember we were sitting in my office, and I remember even saying, well, you know, clearly MidVenture's too small and blah, 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 and, you know, Bill was, you know, Bill, you should be chairman, and Bill said, yes, I should be chairman. And that, and the next thing, that whole deal was come together, and, you know, we at MidVenture, or me being the smallest, you know, we got a small allocation. But it was, there was never any, everybody who had been involved in putting that idea together had the opportunity to be part of it. And everybody got to share ideas, and we would have these sessions, we would sit around and talk about, you know, what these things could lead to, and that was just plain different from the way it is now, you know, and it was, I think the last really sort of collegial deal sort of in MedTech went away as far too much money started flooding into the space. It made it very difficult for little funds doing what certainly MedVentures tried to do to survive, because we got, I think that in hindsight, if I had to do it again, I would have brought in more people, raised more money, and buffered ourselves, because we always stayed small, because I always had this idea, because the first three funds were very successful that way, of just putting smaller amounts of money to work, building value, and then owning, as I say, at least a piece of a larger pie. But once big amounts of money came in, nobody was collegial anymore, and it wasn't a case of being, you know, working with a colleague. It was like, okay, you might have funded this, but I'm taking over now. Mm-hmm. And it just became very different. Mm-hmm. So
that's interesting.
Yeah.
So,
okay, that's it.
No, there's a lot more.
Oh,
so
okay.
We've been talking about your move to LF Rothschild was a bit of a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you were also maybe undergoing some personal challenges at the time, right? You had a cancer diagnosis.
I did. Well, that's actually how I met John Clock, because he was my oncologist.
Well, that ended up being sort of convenient in a strange way, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, we started talking about carbohydrates, you know, while we would, you know, distraction from the cancer therapy. That's right. And I mean, that's also partly, I think, why, you know, I decided that I was going to leave LF Rothschild, because I thought, you know, if I've just got a limited span of time around, and might as well just, you know, do things the way I want to do things. And so, so it was easier to make the decision. Although, I remember thinking to myself, it's going to be very difficult to raise money if I've just, you know, had a cancer diagnosis. And it was very interesting. I found that the health thing didn't actually matter so much, which was very gratifying. You know, we put clauses in the documents saying, well, you know, if I'm incapable, then, you know, US Venture Partners and InterWest will take over. So, I mean, I had these sort of, you know, big brothers sitting around with the first fund. But between, you know, the first and the second fund, there was a big hiatus, because I got diagnosed again at the end of 89, and that was when I thought, okay, this is it, you know, now I'm, you know, I'm never going to be able to raise money again, this is, you know, my future is just way too uncertain. But by the time, you know, we got out to the early 90s, I thought, well, you know, maybe I can, you know, I can't just sit around waiting for the axe to fall. And that was when I got back in business and did the second fund.
Mm. Well, you're very young for so much cancer.
Yeah, I was. When the first diagnosis, I was 35. That was pretty young.
Yeah. So we've talked to a lot of people in the pharmaceutical industry, so it's really interesting to talk with somebody who's so involved. It seems like a lot of your focus was on devices.
Well, in the beginning, it certainly was, because there was no biotech, you know, and so that was why, you know, my branching point with life sciences was just really the size of my funds, because by the time of the third fund, the last investment I did in in biotech was actually one of was a Sandilling deal company called Genteric, and it was just a colossal failure. And I realized I didn't have the sort of funds that could sustain those losses, mm-hmm. because by then biotech deals just were swallowing up huge amounts of money. The difference, this difference has pretty much gone away now, but in the early days with devices and biotech, the thing that I noticed was that device people were still willing to work, you know, very much for the equity, and they were also willing to take a big cut because of the equity. So they would cut in salary and benefits. And I used to get astonished at how the biotech companies were funded by people who come in from big pharma, and they took no cuts in salary. So they got their ownership and they got these big packages, and I thought, wow, this just makes the overhead just humongous. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was a function of the early CEOs in life science. And it's interesting because I think I had this perspective because I was straddling the whole spectrum, that the CEOs of the medical service companies, you know, they weren't overpaid. They were probably paid like the device people. But these biotech people, I was like, wow, I mean, you know, they you know, they just come in and just slide in from big pharma with the same. Now, that devices have caught up in that, by the way. And so, you know, in the days when you used to get these little, you know, worker bees doing devices, that's gone. But in the early days, it was incredible. You could get a CEO, for example, of a medical device company, and maybe you'd pay them, if you paid them $150,000 a year, you thought you were paying a lot. And I can remember that the big pharma guys, the life sciences guys, seldom you got a CEO for under $250,000. Mm-hmm. And that's before the benefits and all this other stuff came in. Mm-hmm. So it was a very different way of thinking about it. And there was always the expectation with life sciences that you were going to raise colossal amounts of money. And the other difference was that with devices, and like I said, a lot of this has gone away now, but now let's talk about anywhere from, you know, 10 to 20 years ago, that you could, any inch of the way with a device, you can titrate it and say, this doesn't look like this trial's working really well. But with life sciences, you break the code after phase three. You might have spent $100 million, $200 million, and it's, whoopsie, it didn't work. We haven't got, you know, statistical efficacy, so all that's gone down. But you don't know till you get there. And so, you know, being a thrifty person and also having small funds, it was easier to do life sciences because, you know, as tough as it was to call a halt and write something off, you weren't writing off, you know, just these massive amounts of money.
Right. And plus you had a background in medical engineering.
I did, but remember I also had a background in chemical engineering. Right. And so, you know, it was really, to me, it didn't really matter. But the other thing was that very early on, the whole life sciences thing became, you know, there were funds set up that just really focused on it. And then, you know, Kleiner Perkins obviously just dominated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, US Ventures once, you know, they'd done Amgen. Well, they didn't do Amgen. Bill did Amgen. But, you know, they got a reputation for being a go-to firm. And then Domain raised money to, you know, be in biotech. And if you were a small fund like mine, or my, you know, MedVenture was, ultimately, you started making a decision, I can't influence it, I'm just along for the ride, and I can't support these levels of capital. So by the time the third fund came, so that was like the late 90s or whatever, I was thinking, you know, I really should move. Although we kept doing tools, like MedVen5, we did a company called Amnis, which was a flow cytometer that images at flow, and so it's a cell sorter. But it images, and so it's actually pretty cool. So, you know, so that was, so we could still do things like that. Mm-hmm. But after Genteric, I thought, oh, I don't know, this is too much money to write off. So that's really how it happened.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that you can think of from the various financing ventures you've been part of? And then we'll talk a little bit about kind of current things that are going on.
Probably not, but if I do, I can always send you emails or whatever. Yeah.
So are you, what are your current projects?
The current projects are all, we've got one wound management company, which is sort of interesting because it's nanofibers where we can actually put in not only hyaluronic acid, but we can put in stem cells, and we're really looking at that and saying we may have a material that has a one, you know, technology fits all kind of dressing. And so that actually moves us back into life sciences. But excepting for that, the other investments we've got right now are really all devices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything specific you'd like to tell us?
Oh yeah, we've got some, because times being what they are, we've basically chosen just to really focus down on taking some, it's changed, I remember when we did Qterra, which was a aesthetic laser company, maybe three. I remember when the company first had revenues, that at a board meeting, Guy Noor and I were laughing, and the CEO said, "Why are you laughing?" I said, "I've never had a company that had revenues before." Because that was, the way it was. We were doing either life sciences or technology, and people bought patents, they bought ideas, they bought research. But now you have to. And so with very limited resources, we've had to take these companies through to not only through clinical trials, but we've actually had to take them into revenues. And so we've got a company called Pulmonix, which has a device that does therapy for emphysema. Mm-hmm. So it's like a little stent, and it will collapse a damaged lobe of the lung. And what happens when that happens is that the healthy or healthier part of the lung will expand into that space. And it's absolutely astonishing what happens to these people. It's like Lazarus. They get out of their wheelchairs, they walk, their 6-minute walk time, their lung function improves. It's also got an assessment device. So you can put in this assessment device that can tell you, can you actually provide therapy to this lung? Is there other crossflow that's going to stop it? So that's a pretty exciting company. We've got another company that does TPA therapy with use of ultrasound, funnily enough, for clot therapy for DVT, for thrombosis, for pulmonary embolism, and it's a company in Seattle, and it's very profitable and growing very fast. So those would be probably our two major ones, and then we've got the wound healing company, and we've only got 14 companies in our various portfolios now, because we've made the decision, my partner Charlie and I, not to raise another fund, because you can't do any more in early stage what we did, or what I did anyway in the beginning with MedVenture, because you can't take a small fund and actually return money to your investors, because it takes too much money. There's too much money available in these sort of mega funds. It's almost become more, the entrepreneurship's gone out of it, which is a pity.
Yeah. Can you walk us through the early MedVentures a little bit more? Yeah. Like you just did this latest one. When did you start MedVen with Charlie?
No. I did that on my own.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
And what were the companies that you were working on then, working with?
Oh, let's see. Well, there was Glycomed, obviously. Mm-hmm. There was a company called DVI, which was the first atherectomy company. There was, Arthrocare was the second fund. There was a company called Symborg Systems, which was the first company that actually linked computers that they could talk together in a hospital. Hmm. It was sort of like a Cisco for medical computers. And I actually think in hindsight that I should have spent way more time focusing on what came after Symbol, because clearly that was that was a major growth industry, as it was. We did a couple of we did a what's the name of it? It's still public today. It does point of care diagnostics. We did that. We did. My mind is just blank. We did an ultrasound company called Acoustic Imaging that we sold. We did Total Pharmaceutical Care, which was another home health care company.
Now, when you say we, who were you working with on these?
Well, when I say we, remember, I was very close to both U.S. Ventures and Interwest at the time. But Interwest, I tended to do more co-investing with Interwest than I did with U.S. Ventures. Funnily enough, despite the support, financial support from U.S. Ventures, the actual support that continued was the one with Interwest. Mm. And I did way more co-investing with Interwest as time went on.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
And so then the first one was successful.
Oh no, the first fund and the second fund both returned 3 times investor capital. Mm-hmm. They were very, very successful.
So how did the first become the second?
Well, I raised another fund.
Okay.
Yeah. I raised another fund. There was a big hiatus between the first and the second just because of the whole illness thing. And so I raised the second one in the mid-90s, and that was pretty successful. The third one, I had a couple of partners then, and we raised that fund, which was a $90 million fund. We raised that in, I think, 98. And that wasn't as successful as the first two. That one doubled. But anyway, on all of those, I mean, the rap on all of the healthcare funds is that they never return any of the carried interest. And actually, I did pretty well on my carried interest, and I have to say. Then the fourth and the fifth fund really have fallen victim to this whole phenomenon that's happened where FDA makes it difficult to get things through, reimbursement's difficult, you don't get rewarded with markups anymore, you need more capital to support your deals, and we had to, with limited capital, revamp our strategy very dramatically in midstream, so that's required massive amounts of work. Mm-hmm. And those funds were 2004 funds. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were there any of the companies that you funded that have particularly tickled your fancy?
A lot of them. Yeah. I mean, Arthrocare was one. Well, these are companies that we sort of did the seed capital. Mm-hmm. Therasense was one, which was a diabetes monitor company. Diasonics, frankly, was one, but that wasn't with the from a med venture. That was one I did myself. Glycomed I liked. Glycomed was a good company. You know, Cutera was great. I mean, Cutera made the whole of Fund 3. Aesthetic lasers. I must say, I never thought in my life I'd be investing in aesthetic lasers, but we did. Because that was sort of the time when I realized that FDA was getting so dramatically difficult that it was time to move into other areas. So we've had altogether, I'm trying to think, I mean, I know on our walls we've got like 26 tombstones from companies that have gone public or been acquired. So our track record's not been bad. And as you know, in the early days, when, like I say, when you found a company and you'd have a consistent funding pattern, we got some very good returns. We had a company called Venturetex where we were the seed capital, and that was the second implantable defibrillator. Mm-hmm. So that was good. Yeah. Wow.
So it seems like in the more recent years, you're saying that the challenges have been sort of procedural and the FDA and a lot of the financing. What were some of the challenges in the earlier years?
There really weren't that many challenges. It was really a very exciting time. I mean, both in life sciences and in devices. I mean, as much as in life sciences are all these discoveries that ultimately led to funding up a lot of blind mm-hmm. alleys, because by and large, life sciences, most of the money's been made in recombinant DNA. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were new materials, there were new, you know, you could make better catheters, there were new batteries, so you could make smaller and smaller devices and implantables. It was a, you know, it was a great, I mean, if you even just look at cardiology, that from the first pacemaker, which was in the 1960s, and then implantable defibrillators and catheters and stents, mm-hmm. and now you've got percutaneous valves, and it's amazing what's been developed. And I mean, if you think about, here's dialysis. I nearly did a PhD with activated charcoal for dialysis, and now you're talking about people walking around wearing portable dialysis. I mean, you go in any area of medical practice. I mean, I have a young friend who just, actually she died in February of lung cancer, but she was an Asian, she was actually an opera singer, and she was kept alive on Tarceva. When she was diagnosed, she was given 3 months to live, she got 4 years. Mm-hmm. Because of Tarceva. I mean, these things are incremental, but, you know, but that's Genentech. Mm-hmm. You know, if it hadn't been for Genentech, where would, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have these kind of drugs that are coming out now, you know, Herceptin.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that if you actually tabulate the breakthroughs that have come, and some of them have been abused, because I think human growth hormone was abused. I did the partnership for human growth hormone, and I still remember thinking, why does any, you know, in those days you could finance off balance sheet. And we did 3 partnerships with Genentech, and one was human growth hormone and alpha interferon. I remember thinking, like, who the hell will buy this stuff? I mean, how many, you know, short stature people are in the US? And I'm so naive, I completely miss the fact that it's a drug of choice for athletes or for gymnasts or for whatever. So humongous, but that was an abuse of it. And I think that, I think EPO has been massively mm-hmm. abused. And what good it's done, there's a dark side to some of this stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that the companies don't, you know, to ask a company, entity to be self-regulating is just, you know, sort of whistling in the wind. But they should self-regulate a bit more on that stuff, I think. You know, there's all these things about EPO being overused by the dialysis companies, and I personally think it's wrong and it's not ethical, and people should. But you can't argue with the creation of these massive new drug companies, you know. So
that's interesting. Yeah. So I would love to hear about your book sale.
But
that
in
sounds
oral,
fascinating.
What, not in
yes.
the oral history.
No, absolutely in the oral history.
I'm going to a book auction actually on the 10th of April.
Yeah. How did you become interested in first editions? My first job in high school was at a rare books bookstore.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Where was it?
In Idaho.
Oh, okay.
It's called Iconoclast Books.
What were they selling? Just
Mostly, well, specializing in Hemingway.
Oh, okay.
And other Western writers.
Oh, okay.
So I've always loved first editions as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know. I got into it in the weirdest way. When I was learning in England in the early 70s, I went into a bookshop one day that there was a... there was an illustrated anatomy book in the window, and I thought, oh, I should get that for my sister. And I remember I went in, and the guy said it was £600. I think £600. But then he started showing me some of the other things that he had, and he had a copy of what was called an aerial poem. There was a whole thing that Faber and Faber did in the early years of the 20th century, where they would get a famous poet to write a poem, then they get a famous illustrator to illustrate it. They do it on handmade paper, they do it as a limited edition, the poet would sign it. And he had this poem by T.S. Eliot called Song for Simeon. There was something that, a poem that I liked. And I remember it was £45. And you know, can imagine, after tax in those days, I was earning £50 a month. So, you know, I bought it. And I remember thinking to myself, I've just blown a month's income on this. What am I going to do? And I thought, well, I'd better just try and see more. And then they had a book fair in London a few months after that. And then I just got hooked on it. And I just started buying books when I could afford it. And then I came here, and there was a guy called Ralph Sipper who was in those days a Marin, and then he later went down to Santa Barbara, and he actually had a lot of Hemingway and Joseph the Provider. And then after a while, I got a bit more money, and I realized I could, you know, indulge myself more. And I had realized that there was a list that the critic Cyril Connolly did in the 50s of the 100 books, in his opinion, in English and French and American, that were the key books of it leading to the modern movement. He did a thing for the humanities research in Austin, called The Modern Movement. He wrote a book. And I looked at the list and I thought, oh, I could collect those books or related books or first editions. And I did. Over the years, I'd get material related to it. And then finally, about 6 years ago, I thought, you know, I'm just kind of about done with Connolly. I disagree with him. I've collected this list. I've got, you know, there's other things that I should be thinking about. So by then, of course, I bought a lot at Sotheby's over the years. So I did a sale through them. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't sell became the basis of essentially what my interests now changed. I'm buying manuscripts and letters. I'm mm-hmm. buying literary letters where the author, for example, I just bought a Thomas Mann letter where he was writing to a critic and explaining what the character of Dr. Faustus in his Dr. Faustus is. Mm-hmm. I just find that really interesting. So,
where do you keep your letters?
I keep all of my stuff at home mm-hmm. in Oakland. I'm sort of hoping that if a burglar breaks in that they won't have enough, you know, that they'll be looking for televisions or computers.
Enough pieces of paper.
They won't be refined enough to figure out that the actual, the most valuable thing in my house is my book collection.
So. Well, I just thought this little tidbit in the bio we had was really interesting. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. That's in our bio?
Well, this is a bio that LSF has.
Oh, okay.
Apparently.
Oh, okay.
You've got a file.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Well, I mean, if you're interested, I can give you a copy just for your personal interest of the catalog.
I would be very interested in that.
Yeah, I had some great stuff. I really did.
Yeah.
But now I've got some really interesting stuff, and you know, and I like, and I've also been buying literary portraits, which is interesting.
Interesting.
You know, I've got two portraits of photographic portraits of Ian Forster when he was a young man tutoring in India, you know, sitting in a circle with this Indian family where he was a tutor. And then I've also got a collection of letters that he wrote to a young man called Masood, with whom he was very much in love, and all these really, and the family sold the letters, but then they were very careful. They sold also letters that Masood had written to his wife when he married later to point out, you know, Forster may have written these letters to Masood, but, you know.
Nothing happened.
No. That was, you know, I've got some letters that Virginia Woolf wrote where she was like, to somebody who had asked her something about To the Lighthouse. Well, you may put that interpretation on. I don't put that interpretation on.
Don't interpret my books.
That's right.
Yeah. That's great.
So I should probably hit back.
Yeah. So. Well, it was wonderful to meet you.